This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking to Marion Winnick. She's the author of many books, seven or more, I think. And what we're talking about today is a group of three, what I would call small books, that are collected, collected essays. And these three books were published digitally by a company called SheBooks. The three books are called August in Paris, The End of the World as We Know It, and now I've lost the third one, Guesswork.
Yes.
So, Marion, tell me, and it's really good to have you on to talk.
Maybe yay.
Talk a little bit about these three books, you know, what it is, how they came about, and how they're related.
Okay. You know, first of all, my print books are all either collections of essays, and then there's a couple that are book-length memoirs. So basically, I am a personal essayist, and that's what I've been doing most of my career. My very first two books when I was in my early 20s are books of poetry. And how I got started was I was a commentator on All Things Considered for 15 years, from 1991 to 2006. And, you know, I was doing those little three-minute essays that they used to have and don't have so much more at the end of the half hour, where people would kind of talk about stuff in their personal lives. That's what I do. That's what I've been doing. That's what's in all these books, more or less. So it's kind of narrating the things that have unfolded in my life, which have ranged from quite, you know, ordinary and, you know, wonderful in their ordinary way, to also I've had a lot of pretty big loss and tragedy. I was widowed young and became a single mom in the time of AIDS. And so that's some of my work. Then in the past 4 years, I've been writing a biweekly column in this online thing called the Baltimore Fishbowl. And it's been great because it's kind of like back to the days on All Things Considered when I had an outlet for so much, you know, almost as much as I could do. And so that's how this fishbowl thing has sort of felt to me in a funny way, like NPR part two, because I've been writing so much to you know, have this column. So it's kind of, you know, you hate to see some of the columns I thought were a little more worthy to hang around than others. And I was sad to kind of see them drift away into the distance on the internet. And then SheBooks started, and their goal was to put out these, like you said, smaller books. And they were looking for women authors. And actually, SheBooks is run by a bunch of people who like got kicked out of the magazine. You know, the ever smaller magazine industry has caused there to be a lot of editors and extra people running around. So some of these magazine people are who started SheBooks. And I used to write a lot for women's magazines. That's how I met them. And when they came calling to me, I had like a 4-year backlog of essays from the column. So the three books you mentioned are thematic collections. One of them is about parenting. One of them is about travel. And one of them is a little bit philosophical, kind of about memory itself. And that's a long answer to a short question.
Well, no, but that's what we want. And and I have probably some specific things to ask about these individual books, but I also kind of want to talk to you a little bit about the nature of your writing. I'm really interested in, because I mean, you know, it's some people find it very easy to talk about their lives, and other people find it very difficult to do that. Obviously, you fall into the first group,
right.
Although maybe it's easy now, maybe it wasn't originally, but I wanted to ask you about how you became a commentator for NPR. What was it that got you to begin talking about yourself?
It's totally in my personality. Like when I was 9 years old, I was writing, you know, poems about my deep emotions. And I mean, I was definitely born this way. Poetry was the first way that I expressed this, you know, burning need to tell everyone what I'm thinking and what's happening to me. But in the late 80s, I started writing short prose pieces for the alternative newspaper where I was living, Austin, Texas, the Austin Chronicle. And actually, in the middle 80s, we really didn't have, there wasn't such a big concept that there, as there is now, of personal essay and memoir and creative nonfiction as really active literary genres. Like back then, if you went to graduate school for creative writing, your choices would be poetry, fiction, and maybe playwriting, but certainly not creative nonfiction. So not until 1995, actually, was there even a graduate program in creative nonfiction. So this is 10 years before that. So I had not really, the kind of thing that we see now, like it's so common from every, you know, David Sedaris to much, you know, every type of personal essay and book like memoirs, like even Tobias Wolff and Mary Carr. Okay, these things were in there, were just starting then. And so I, along with I think a lot of people in the middle 80s and late 80s, started writing this sort of like refound this form. I'm not saying, of course, we didn't invent it. I mean, Rene Montaigne was writing essays in the 16th century or something like that. And but this whole contemporary resurgence of this form is now has started happening. And so I wouldn't have known that at the time. And at the time, I didn't even say, wouldn't have said the word essay. I would say I wrote a humor piece about trying to get pregnant. Or I wrote, you know, I just didn't even know what to call them. And it seemed very unusual to me that you could just start typing away and tell a story about your life in your own voice without the, you know, all the rhetorical devices of poetry and without the fictionalizing that you might do in a short story. So I was like, wow, you know, do you think you can really do this? and I think a lot of people were saying that at the same time. So in my case, I started publishing these things in the Chronicle, and there's an NPR reporter named John Burnett, who's done wonderful reporting for them for decades all over the world, but he's based in Austin. And at the time, I didn't know him, but he sent me a postcard, because that's how long ago this was, that you had to send someone a postcard in a, if you wanted to tell them something. And, asked me if I would like to try coming over to his house, record a couple of the things that he'd read in the Chronicle, and he would take them up to D.C. And he was our interaction was interrupted because he was sent to cover Operation Desert Storm. But when he got back from Saddam Hussein watch, we recorded the first couple, and they got on the air. And so that just, it sort of started. So I had this relationship as a freelancer with NPR for the next 15 years. And it, everything else that happened to me came because of that. Like a literary agent heard me, and that's how those first three Random House books came out. And magazines that previously didn't seem that interested in me were much more interested in me. And, you know, I think I was basically part, I would always say it was, you know, a movement, a literary movement that of the late 80s and 90s when memoir and personal essay had this big renaissance. And now, you know, that there's sort of the backlash where nobody liked memoirs and personal essays anymore. But I think it's safe to say that they have assumed a place in the creative writing spectrum now.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, maybe the form, I mean, where part of the popularity is that it's a way of expressing, it's talking about things that other people are feeling and thinking, and fiction can do that as well, obviously. But I think it struck a chord. You know, it's hard. I don't think that anybody really could say exactly why the personal essay or the creative nonfiction format became so much more popular, but it certainly has. Well, but
I think it's, you know, look at the whole culture with the interest in truth and reality shows, and even in the low, you know, in high and low culture, there's like a lowering of the idea of boundaries of privacy and things that you wouldn't tell anyone. And that has really changed. And so in my opinion, it's like kind of a high culture phenomenon that corresponds to the same thing as daytime talk shows, webcams, reality TV, more interest in documentaries, just this whole things that people would have never told about themselves without either shame or fiction. Now it's common to say these things.
Well, that's true. But it's hard to figure out what it is about our culture that enables that. You know, I think, you know, when I studied fiction in college, one of my favorite class was called Strategies of Indirection in Fiction. It was taught by a guy named David Milch. And it really captured my imagination, a way of understanding how fiction works. And of course, creative nonfiction is doing something completely different. There is much less indirection, if any.
There's certainly all the craft. Like, you still have to create scenes. You still have to bring characters to life. You still have to craft dialogue. You know, there's a really similar toolkit. But in fiction, you can layer your theme into both into the plot and into kind of like, maybe this is part of what indirection was about. Like, in fiction, there's all these like ways that you can saturate what you're trying to say into what you're doing. But, and it's, and because you can imagine not just the plot, but literally everything, you have so much control. In creative fiction, nonfiction, one thing is set up for you already, and that is the plot. But, you know, look at the most, but in some of the most ambitious works of creative nonfiction, you can see that there's more than just the technical craft of characterization and dialogue and description, and that people have done some of that leveling that I'm talking about, layering of the theme. Like one book, I teach creative nonfiction, so I think about this all the time, of course. And like a book that my students are reading this semester is Dave Eggers' Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, which, have you read that?
I have not.
Oh, you should. Well, it's, you know, this book is a lot about, it has a lot of meta stuff in it about whether, you know, telling stories about yourself and whether they're true or not. And I guess I've become really interested in the ways that that can be a part of the story we tell about ourselves. We can also talk about the story that we're telling about ourselves.
Yeah, no, I understand. And I think also, you know, it's still, as you just said, it's about telling a story. And, you know, if you are telling a story that happens to be true, it's still a story. And you have to figure out where the dramatic points are and what it is that's going to connect someone to the story. You know, and it often, I think, humor helps, or a sense of irony, particularly irony about yourself, you know, is a kind of, maybe that's a trope, but it's certainly a strategy that helps make the story sympathetic to others and make and enables others to connect, because it isn't, you know, you have to soften the meanness of it.
Right. Well, like one of the things I talk about a lot with students is self-implication. Like, nobody's interested in the story of how all these horrible things happened to you and you were such a victim and it's none of it was your fault because everyone is such a jerk. That is just not a good story.
Right.
You know, but what is interesting is a story where bad things happen to you, but you have some understanding of, you know, your role in these events, not necessarily that you're all to blame for it, but that, you know, the ways in which you allowed the things to happen to you, invited them, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, this is something I dealt with a lot in my memoir, First Comes Love. That's the book about where I was widowed, my husband died of AIDS, and I was a little, you know, single mom at 34. But the thing is, you know, we were crazy IV drug abusing partiers, and a lot of the bad things that happened to me were certain invited by my own behavior. So I think one of the things that, and you probably saw touches of this even in the personal essay, you know, my thing that I do is I have a lot of candor about my mistakes, and I'm not afraid to say that I did this bad thing and it was kind of stupid and here's what happened. And I think that's one of the reasons that people respond to my work, because they're just kind of stunned that it's possible to admit in the public forum, you know, I wasn't the greatest mom. I wasn't, and also it's not that I'm a total failure at all these things. You know, I'm okay, but I've made a lot of mistakes, and I, as you said, I find humor in them, but I'm not so ashamed of them that I can't talk about it. And I think that's just a really big relief for people to find out that, you know, you can make mistakes and you can come back from it. And telling the story is part of coming back from it.
Right. Well, no, and I think you help. Actually, I did notice that in these three books, that there's a certain naturalness about the way you talk. It doesn't feel forced at all, and that you are humanizing these experiences for other people in telling them about, in sort of telling tales about yourself. You're humanizing all of us and giving us, you know,
In the travel book where at the resort Atlantis in the Bahamas.
Yes.
And there's a scene where my sons are smoking a joint on the balcony of this hotel, and I go out and I hit a pot, which I haven't smoked in years, and I like pretty much go completely mental and have this really insane day at the water park trying to behave like a normal mom. And anyway, this is a story a lot of people would not tell about themselves. And on the other hand, it's not a story that is completely unfamiliar to everyone. So, you know, that's kind of one of the things I have going for me, is that I would even say that that happened, and then go into it. But of course, you know, I had to check it out with everyone concerned to make sure that they were okay with me telling the story. But I think, yeah, I feel like I've already said so many, I've already been so bad and messed up so much that it doesn't really even matter anymore.
Well,
I'm almost 60 years old. I have grown children. Everything's fine.
Well, I did want to ask you about, I have to ask you about the people in your life who are in your stories, obviously. It must be, I don't even understand how some of them may feel, because, and the fact, maybe, you know, it's complicated, obviously, because you have not always great relationships with people, and you have to talk about that.
Like, what are you thinking of?
Oh, I guess, you know, maybe the mother-in-law or...
You certainly picked the most, that's the one that's the most complicated. I'm very, in general, I have like an absolute policy of like showing everybody everything I write about them before I publish it. And I am not willing to sacrifice a relationship over a piece of writing. So if somebody wants me to change something, you know, I would. But my mother-in-law of my late husband, Tony, is the one person that is not true of. And, you know, so I've had, first of all, I don't think she's read very many things that I have written, nor does she want to. She's not interested in it, and in a way, she just doesn't care. I mean, this idea of the world of, you know, people who read and write books like this is just not that interesting to her. So I know some people in her family read my books, and a lot of them are even, you know, they're fans and stuff. So with Grace, I have to imagine, you know, I imagine that I'm her, and I always like, I feel like she's not a person I can send an essay to and say, I'm thinking about writing this. What do you think? That's not going to happen with her. So I have to like play her in my head. And in the one essay that you read about the graduation in New Orleans.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you'll notice there's a big paragraph in there where I like try to explain probably how this looks to her, you know? And I think I try hard to give the reader like a chance to sympathize as much with her point of view as mine, you know? And she's a huge character in the memoir of her son's death, which comes up. And so I've been dealing with her in my writing for a long time without really being able to use my standard approach. Because believe me, if I said, I want you to read something I wrote and see if it's okay, she'd just say, really? Because I'm not going to. You know, she just doesn't care. But I kill myself to be fair to her. And I think people do. they get it, you know. People come away and they take her side. They say, you know, poor Grace. Yeah, you.
Right, but do you feel like people who maybe meet you, or, you know, you're in, like say they meet you or they're dealing with you for the first time and they know that you write about everybody when things happen, do you think it affects how they interact with you?
No, because mostly people don't mind being written about, even though the general assumption is that, you know, nobody wants to be written about. Really, it's more likely for people to be mad at you if you leave them out. I mean, people do like to be written about, as long as you don't say, like, you know, they're ugly or something like that. But the funniest story about this is, you know, my last hardcover book was called Highs in the Low 50s, and it's about, I got divorced in 2008, and then I spent a few years, you know, really thinking I was going to get out there and find me a man, and tried, you know, online, this, that. And then I wrote this book about it. So all those people that, you know, I really didn't know very well and had these short encounters with are in this book. But I tracked every single one of them down and let them read their chapter. So, you know, I'd be writing these emails like, you may not remember me, but I've written a chapter about you in my book about our relationship. So this chapter, it was really funny. And several people that were kind of jerks to me, they wrote that. I mean, the reaction was, boy, I'm a jerk. But, you know, everybody's mentioned with a nickname or some kind of disguise, and anything that they said did change, I changed. But I thought, okay, after I publish this book, it's definitely true that I will never, ever go on another date because everyone will know I wrote this book. Pretty much has proven true, unfortunately.
Well, and of course, but I think you're right. I think most people probably don't mind that they're a character. But what about your children? How do they feel about
it? Well, two different things. My older son, well, there's three kids. My older son, who's 26, you know, everyone says, well, of course he doesn't mind because he's always portrayed as the king of the universe. And it's true. But he's, you know, if we got him on the phone right now, he'd say, I'm very proud of my mom. And I'm very proud of him too. His younger brother, who's usually, you know, the grumpy rebel, has gotten very angry at me a few times, and we've had a lot of back and forth. And I've actually, you know, he ended up living at home for a while after college, and I was writing these ha ha hilarious to me essays about it, but they weren't that funny to him. So we had a few showdowns and stuff. And I even wrote an essay about how he didn't want me to write about him anymore. And he just thought that was like the most unbelievably screwed up thing that ever happened in the history
Right. You could understand how that feeling comes about.
No, you can understand. You know, so I really try to lay off him because he's also, you know, he's a musician. He's an artist. He's a public person in his own way. Like, he doesn't want to be my character. You know, his older brother and his younger sister, I think partly because they aren't artists themselves, they just don't care that much. Jane loves me to write about her. I mean, my daughter, who's 14, has grown up in the Kardashian age, you know, like where the best thing that can happen to you is your family is humiliated on television. I mean, you know, so she has a totally different idea, she has a really different sense of privacy than people in older generations do. She doesn't think it's that weird that, you know, her mom writes about her family because look at what's on TV.
Well, that's true. And then people put everything on Facebook. So,
right, exactly. So for her, it's much less of a shocking thing than for the than for older generations. I did a really funny interview with her about this when one of my books came out. I'm saying this because she's the one who expressed it to me, pointing out, like, well, you know, the Kardashians' mom wrote a memoir and you're a much better writer than she is. So, I was happy to hear that.
Well, and it is a fair point. There are so many television shows which are about people and kind of dramatizing or making into entertainment the daily lives of any number of people in any number of different situations. Although I think writing is, there is a level in which your essays should be differentiated, I think, from...
Of course.
You know.
I mean, you know, I hope so. I hope so. I mean, I am not... It's nothing like reality television, and that's why, you know, years ago I was approached that our family should be on Trading Spouses, and that we were going to be the atheist family, and then some other family was going to be the fundamentalist Christian family, and they were going to send that mom to live with my kids, and I was going to go live with them for a week, and I was absolutely no way, you know, because first of all, I knew the only purpose of the show would be to make fun of us, you know, and but that kind of, yeah, I want to make this, for me, I'm making the story into art with the purpose of doing something useful and meaningful and, you know, things that help people feel better. But I don't think that that's what, that Trading Spouses really shares that goal with me. So I've been very resistant to, you know, being involved in that kind of way with stuff.
Right. No, in that way, I think clearly the difference is one is exploitive and the other and your writing is not. You know, you're the people you're writing about, you're not exposing them for salacious purposes or to make people you know, think ill of them. So I think there's a,
and I'll just say that I'm, you know, I really take it seriously that I believe that my relationships are more important than my writing. So if I check something with someone and they are really uncomfortable with it, just either not do it or, you know, find out what I would have to do for them to be comfortable. But there have been the whole essays that I just thought, you know what, I'm just not going to do this because it's not worth it.
Right.
And not every writer feels this way. I mean, there's the most famous counter example is Anne Sexton. They asked her, you know, what was her feelings about all these things she's written about her family. And she said, well, I think my work is more important than my family.
Right. Which is, right. That's very revealing. In fact, well, I want to, there's so many other things to talk about, but we've actually covered a lot of ground. I want to ask you one more question just for fun right now. What's your favorite book
right now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're asking at a great time because I just was one of the three judges for the Kirkus Prize for Fiction.
Yeah.
And we just gave a check for $50,000 to supposedly the best book of the last year. And we gave it to a book called Euphoria by Lily King, a fiction writer from Maine. And it's a fabulous novel. And it's based on the life of Margaret Mead. It's a skinny little book. It's so great. It had a lot of competition because it was every book from October 2013 to October 2014. And we went through them all. Yeah, I have a, so read Euphoria by Lily King.
Oh, that's great. Well, I really appreciate your letting me know about that. That's a book I'd like to read. Well, thank you so much for talking. And I hope that we'll get to talk another time. This has been...
Me too.
Writers...
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Marion Winnick about three different books, August in Paris, The End of the World as We Know It, and Guesswork, which are all published by SheBooks. And it's a digital publishing company, so you need to look for them online in the iBook store and on Amazon.
You know what? Can I say that the easiest way to find out about my books is go to marionwinnick.com. And you can kind of get a little synopsis of all of them and find them where they may be.
Great idea. Thank you.